Welcome to the podcast edition of American Warrior Radio with Ben Bueller Garcia, presented by Medicare Mentors. American Warrior Radio, telling the stories of the American men and women who protect us at home and abroad. And now, here is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia.
We all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Suicide is an adversary that is killing more of our airmen than any enemy on the planet. Those words came from Air Force Chief of Staff General David Goldfein. Goldfein recently ordered a branch-wide resiliency operational pause. Every unit in our United States Air Force was ordered to select one day between August 1st and September 15th to stop operations and focus upon giving airmen time back to connect and break down barriers to getting help. At the time of the general's order, the Air Force had seen 78 suicides, placing it on a trajectory of 150 airmen potentially taking their own lives by the end of the year. Now, I'm not a military leader, but every single one of us should comprehend that if the preeminent military in the world is losing more of our warriors to their own hands than attacks by the enemy, we, all of us, have a problem. Our guest today, well, I'll tell you, I have mixed feelings. I'm saddened by the fact that she is able to speak to this subject from personal experience, but I am happy she's able to be here and speak to us from personal experience. She retired from the Air Force 1 year ago after serving as a security forces defender. She continues to support her fellow airmen as an Air Force Wounded Warrior Program ambassador and peer mentor. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Air Force Master Sergeant Retired, Lisa Goad.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm okay, Lisa. You're going to have to hold me up. This is going to be a rough one for me and probably for you too, but you're a professional.
Oh, well, yeah, I don't know about that, but I'll definitely be here. You know, the biggest part of my recovery is being able to share my story and empower others. So hopefully we can reduce or completely eliminate, you know, what's affecting our military.
Wouldn't that be a wonderful day?
Absolutely. Yes.
Lisa, let's back up a little bit. Talk about, we've had defenders on the show before, but that's been a while ago. Tell our listeners what an Air Force defender does. What is their mission?
Sure. So as a defender now, we have a mix of law enforcement responsibilities, mostly at our stateside assignments. And then as we deploy, then our responsibilities to defend our base and our assets that we have that travel over with us. So depending on what base you're at, it really kind of varies in your responsibilities, other than the law enforcement part. You know, depending on what assets are at each base, it's how you're responsible for protecting those. So it's almost a combination of being a law enforcement officer and then also security and defense, which is why we have the name Defender.
So your mission is to protect, defend, and fight, which I'm guessing requires both physical and mental toughness.
Yes, absolutely. It takes a lot, obviously, physical, you know, strength in order to be able to stand against any attackers, but you also have to have that mental preparedness to, you know, be prepared for what's going to happen and then to react in the proper way when something does happen.
As a defender, how does it make you feel? I mean, your job is to protect your fellow airmen, not just the assets, but the man and woman next to you or serving elsewhere on the base or overseas. As a defender, how does it make you feel to know that other airmen are taking their own lives?
It is actually, it's incredibly heartbreaking. You know, I chose this career. I did it for 21 years. I never wanted to do, you know, anything else. And I woke up every day with the pride knowing that, you know, that I was protecting others, or while you were sleeping at night, we were there standing guard to protect you. And so to know that we as a defender can't protect people from harming themselves, in that sense of being, you know, being able to respond ahead of time. It's tragic, and it's frustrating to see how our Air Force is just struggling overall with mental health.
Lisa, I've always believed, and particularly in the years doing this show and talking to a lot of heroes, there's courage in battle and there's courage after battle. I tell you what, I really appreciate your courage that you're out there talking about this now. So tell us your story.
Sure. So my story actually began just like a little over a decade ago. I was stationed in Guam. And so it was me, it was my oldest daughter, she was about 9 or 10 at the time, and my fiance, who was also a service member. One night, he got incredibly intoxicated, and it basically took over me physically and raped and beat me that night. And I struggled that night, and you know, I'm embarrassed to say now, but I always share to others how confused I was about what had happened because we were in a relationship. And in 2008, you know, we were not even as the Air Force, just as the military in general, we were very naive to sexual assaults and rapes and what to do as a military service to react. And as a defender, I had responded to so many incidents like my own and knew how the victim had been treated and how poorly sometimes the victim would be have treated and blamed, that I was afraid to come forward that night. The next day, I actually confronted my fiance, and he, again, because he was so drunk, he didn't even remember what had happened, and therefore he refused to acknowledge what had happened and just wanted to drop the situation. And I every time I thought about it, I really struggled with maybe I just kind of overreacted what had happened just because we had been in this relationship. You know, in years later, I started to really understand how much of a manipulator and controlling he was, where he was, you know, really controlling that decision for me. I had tried to report it several times. I reported it to other defenders who are mandatory reporters, but they just didn't understand the process well enough to report for me when I wasn't strong enough to say so. I had tried reporting it to a chaplain, and probably one of the saddest parts of my story is in his ignorance or misunderstanding of what had happened, he stated that, you know, we were in a relationship and I was supposed to understand my fiance's needs and wants, and that I was supposed to bow to those needs and wants, is what he said exactly. And that, coming from an officer and coming from somebody of faith that I trusted, I believed that I was basically misinterpreting the situation, and made the decision that I wasn't going to try to report it again. But I had a lot of physical issues from it. I had a lot of hip issues and back and neck. And so when I sought medical treatment, I lied. I said because of my job and the physical demands that our job makes us, it makes it completely plausible for me to say I was hurting because of work, and nobody questioned it. And so I held that lie for 8 years and got the medical help I needed for the physical part of my body, but in that lie of not actually saying what had happened. When I eventually did end the relationship with him, but it took me over a year to get the strength to end it. And when I did, he didn't want to end the relationship and stalked me for almost a year, basically until I left the island.
Lisa, let me interrupt you there, because I'm a civilian. I never served, but I got to tell you, as you're describing your story and your situation, both myself and my producer, we're looking at each other just shaking our heads. It's incomprehensible. Explain to it a little bit more about mandatory reporting. What does that mean?
Sure. So I'm not sure about what year it had started, but I know it was kind of around that time, so I know it was fairly new. But the military created restricted reporting and unrestricted reporting. And so what that did was that allowed the victim could make a restricted report, which meant that she could seek medical help, physically and mental health. She could have a victim advocate that would help her, like, through counseling. But she didn't have to report that incident on the law enforcement side, and she wasn't forced to prosecute what had happened. And so what the an unrestricted report is basically what you would see in a civilian life. Everything would you know, process as if you were reporting a crime. But with a restricted report, that victim remained anonymous. Not even her command knew what had happened, or he, what had happened. And so it allowed that victim to get the help that they needed to try to recover. But if they didn't feel safe, you know, facing their attacker or going through a prosecution, then they didn't have to, but they still could get help.
We need to take a pause here a little bit, not just for commercials, but I got to take a breath. So you ended the relationship. No, again, I admire your courage. You ended the relationship, but the battle wasn't quite over yet. We'll talk more about that when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined by Lisa Goad here on American Warrior Radio. If you are struggling or know someone who's struggling, please call the National Suicide Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255. There's also the Veterans Crisis Hotline, 800-273-8255. Press 1. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Lisa Goad. Lisa is a survivor, a mentor, an advocate, an ambassador. She's lots of things. And among those, she is awfully courageous to be out there now telling her story in order to help other people. Lisa, when I interrupted the story of how you got to where you are now, we had just talked about how you finally had the courage to leave this abusive relationship. But that didn't end the battle, did it?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, he stalked me. He used to come and break in my house and, you know, just awful things for about a year until I was finally able to leave. I, you know, really tried to report it, but unfortunately did not have good leadership in my unit. But I did have one person that really helped me. And so eventually what I did was I moved into a women's shelter. I sent my daughter back to the States, and then he helped me move into a women's shelter. So basically, you know, he could no longer find me until I left. And so when I got to my next assignment, I actually went to Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. And I moved forward to what I thought was moving forward, but really I was just kind of pretending that nothing was wrong anymore. And went on with my life. And what I know now is how I really just kind of smacked a bandit on something that hadn't healed yet, and was living in this struggle. I had PTSD, but I didn't know it. I physically was reminded every day of what had happened because I had such chronic pain. And so about 8 years later, I finally made the decision to come forward and to report it. And through, you know, multiple agencies helping me, I had finally came forward at medical and was honest. I had met my husband at New Mexico, and we were married, and we had gotten married and had a child, and he knew everything that had happened. And so he was, you know, an amazing supporter. And my unit leadership that I had in New Mexico was incredibly supportive of people coming forward and helping. And so it was a different type of environment where I felt safe and that I could finally get the help that I needed in the right way.
Now, what year was this?
So I came forward in 2016. So it was 8 years after my rape.
Okay. Was Sparky the commander there at Holloman at the time?
I don't know if that's his nickname.
Okay.
It was Colonel Day. Yeah.
Okay. No, wrong guy. But I'm a big fan of his work. He's it's not important. So the and part of the reason we do this show is to inform civilians, because for me, Lisa, stepping back as someone who believes and supports the military. Again, I use that word incomprehensible. And is there not a way in cases like this where they can just get you to another assignment to separate you, to get you to another base right away? Or is that just not the way the system works?
So that actually is, we do have, it's called an expedited transfer.
Okay.
But because when I reported, nobody took my report seriously, it never got to that process where I would have been transferred back when I was stationed in Guam. But that is a policy that's still effective today, and so that the victim can leave it not only for safety from his or her attacker, but also, you know, for fear of reprisal or how that victim will be treated in their own work environment. So it allows them to go somewhere else and where nobody knows what happened, in a sense, and that they can kind of move forward with their career.
Lisa, I don't know if this is the right terminology or even context, but as your story moved forward, like I would guess happens so often in the civilian world, then when you finally had the courage to come up and the prosecution should have revved up, you were sort of victimized one more time.
Correct. Yeah. So when I did come forward, like I said, I had amazing leadership in my command who helped me through the entire process. I was assigned what's called a special victims counsel, and it's basically an attorney who specializes in incidents that are considered special victims. So although there was a prosecutor, she was assigned to me and helped me through the process, explaining it and guiding me and kind of being my advocate. When I first started the process of reporting, I had met with the prosecutors and they, you know, had said, you know, we obviously have an uphill battle seeing as the length of time that has passed. But they said, as long as you continue to help the process, we will continue to fight for you. And so we did go all the way to a hearing. It's called the Article 32 hearing. It's similar to what you would think would be a grand jury, except the defense is there as well. All the evidence is presented, and then a judge decides what the charges will be. And so the charges were rape by force, which is one of the severest charges possible for us, for him. And shortly before the trial was supposed to proceed, it's called a change of command. Civilian role, just one commander replaces another as they move forward, you know, through their career. Well, the new commander for the JAG office made the decision that he didn't feel the case warranted a trial, even though the judge had said so. And so he dropped all charges on the case.
Tell us about Lisa's night.
Yeah, it was a rough night when my special victims counsel had called and to let me know. Not only had that happened, but when the case essentially was given back to his leadership, the leadership made the decision not to take any punishment or discipline as well. I just felt like my life was over. I had spent so many years living with this chronic pain that reminded me what had happened. And then also when I finally came forward, I had the strength to finally come forward, and then basically felt like the door had been shut in my face, and I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to be in pain. I didn't want to live in fear, and my chance to face my attacker was ripped out of me. I left work after that phone call, and I took my personal weapon, and I drove to the mountains, which is near where I was stationed. And I did it in the sense that I knew that it would be so far away from anything that even if I somehow messed up killing myself, that nobody would find me for so long that I would guarantee that I had completed this suicide. And so I was sitting in my car and I was just basically writing a note to my husband. And it wasn't even an apology note. I didn't feel like I was doing something wrong. I felt like this was the only thing, that option that I had had. And a friend had texted me. And so I had gotten enrolled in the Air Force Wounded Warrior program earlier that, like about 18 months prior, when I had gotten diagnosed with PTSD. And a friend who was also in the program from the same base had texted me, and it was just random. He just wanted to talk. And we were conversing back and forth on text messages, and it basically pulled me back enough to be able to better assess what had happened that day and to process what had happened. And then it gave me an answer of, I had family that was there to take care of me, my Air Force family, and I had responsibilities to take care of them and my own family. And so I made the decision to not kill myself and to go home and get better help. And I let my husband know, I let my doctor know what had happened, and got a more intensive process of help to fight that suicide feeling that I was having.
Lisa, I often, as I've had guests on the show and we talk about people who are considering suicide, we talk about the importance of them reaching out to someone. And I thought your story was going to go on in that direction, but really it was luck, I guess. I mean, or timing.
Luck.
I mean, there's a reason, I believe, why things happen in life, and there's a reason that you started receiving those text messages right at that point in time.
Absolutely. And that's how I feel as well. You know, myself and him and two other people from Holloman all got enrolled in the program around the same time and went to one of the Air Force Wounded Warrior events together. And the person that coordinated did that for a reason, so that when we came back and we were in this tiny, you know, in area of where Holloman is, that we had each other no matter what. And that even if we believed that everybody else had turned their backs on us, that we had each other. And so I purely think yes, maybe you could say it was luck and good timing, but like you said, I think it was just, it was meant to be. We were meant to all take care of each other. And he sensed or knew his responsibility in a way that to send that text message. And I can say that night, I never let him know what happened. I ended the conversation without even sharing, because I was ashamed at that point. And when I became trained as an ambassador last year is when I finally had the courage to come forward and to tell him, I mean, how he essentially saved my life. And how thankful I was.
Lisa, very, very powerful stuff. I tell you that, I'd like to think that now that ends the sad part of why you're here with us.
Yes.
And for the rest of the show, I want to talk about the glad part of why you're here. Ladies and gentlemen, if you or someone you know is having challenges or struggling, please call the National Suicide Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255. Also, the Veterans Crisis Hotline, 1-800-273-8255. Press button 1. Or, like in Lisa's case, you can also text 838-255. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with Lisa Goad. I tell you, she is clearly an example of courage after battle. And Lisa, I can't say too many times how proud I am of you for coming out and using your story and your experiences to help others. Even though you left the Air Force, you're still fulfilling the mission of a defender.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Wow, I just shut you down, didn't I?
Oh, no.
let's talk. You had gone into the Wounded Warrior program with the idea, I'm guessing, of using adaptive sports as a way to help yourself, to build your resiliency. And it's you had made that decision before this fateful night. Was that, do you think, in retrospect, do you think your participation in that program also reinforced or helped you a little bit at that point in time?
Oh, absolutely. When you go on the physical side of you know, my injuries, it was, you can't do this anymore, you can't do this, and you know, doctors saying don't run, or you know, you'll break your hip again, or and whatnot. And when you get to the event, you know, adaptive sports is one of the biggest portions, but there are other, you know, other things as well. But what, you know, when I said I can't run, and then the coach is like, okay, well, we'll put you in this wheelchair racing chair, and you can, you know, you can do that instead. And so throughout the week, you get introduced. Back then it was 9 sports. Now I believe there's 13. There's so many sports. And you get, when you get introduced, it's, okay, what is your injury or your limitations? Okay, now you can do this sport with these adaptations instead of, no, sorry, you can't complete this. I mean, like I did archery sitting in a chair because my balance was, you know, was so poor. Swimming is a huge fear of mine, but it felt so much relief on my body because of just being in the water. And so I took up swimming, and one part of it was just, you know, how it made me feel. But then the other part was I was determined to battle my fear of water and overcome it. And then I did wheelchair racing, cycling, because I don't have range of motion in my legs. I race with a hand cycle. So I pedal with my arms, which is hard, but completely gratifying that I can still do all of these sports. And most of them I had never even done before at all. And then use that to keep me physically fit, which then helped me stay mentally fit, because I was exercising, I had a purpose, I had things to do. And then I had this new community of people that were also struggling with their things and using sports as a way to get through. And so everything became relatable.
Lisa, you know, your words make me think of, I had the real pleasure and honor of spending several days with a severely wounded veteran, Bobby Henlein. And his key phrase is, you know, don't think about what's wrong with you. Think about what's strong with you. And in your case, I would guess, and how, I mean, you won, what, 10 medals so far now in the Wounded Warrior Games?
Yes, 10 medals. And, oh my gosh, I don't know how many from Air Force trials. And last year I got to compete in the regional games for the Paralympics. I'm not too old to do anything after that point, but I got to at least do the region part of it. And talk about, that's pretty much my life now. I retired. My husband is active duty. So the same week that I retired, we moved to here to for his assignment. And I took the year and decided I wasn't going to work. I was really going to work on my health mentally and physically, and just kind of really try to ground myself. And I do that just through as many sports opportunities as I can, you know, take advantage of. And then also just having so much time with my youngest daughter. My oldest she's gone out of the house and married and lives out of state. And so I kind of, you know, my whole career was, she spent my whole career with me gone so much or, you know, working long hours. And so our youngest one, I'm completely taking advantage of being able to spend so much time with her.
Lisa,
I mean, that's my life. Yeah.
Well, I tell you, folks can find out more about the Air Force Wounded Warrior Program. Visit woundedwarrioraf.mil. One thing that really jumped me out in exploring that website, and it lists the mission statement of the program, and there's one phrase that really jumped out at me: staying in contact with them throughout the process as an airman for life. And that is a very powerful statement. This program is not there just to help folks while they're in the service and active duty, but also as an airman for life. Tell us, and part of your engagement, as I understand it, is help fulfilling that portion of the mission statement. Tell us about the Recovering Airman Mentorship Program. I think you're a peer mentor through that.
Yes, I am. Yeah, so yeah, I encourage everybody to check out the website to see how many programs are part of Air Force Wounded Warrior. And so I had a mentor at my first event, and so then I signed up to be a mentor as well. And basically, the program pairs mentors and mentees. So it will be somebody that has been in the program longer or is like further along in their recovery, and they will be paired with somebody that's new in the program that needs assistance. And it could be, you know, like they have the same injury or illness or similar situations, maybe struggling with trying to retain duty to stay in the service or to help them as they transition out. And so typically you're paired with somebody of the same gender and that has this is the same injury or illness. And so for me, it's been so great to be able to connect with people that are struggling with whether or not they want to report. And so I'm able to share, kind of like we talked about the restricted reporting, that, you know, it's not for everybody to report what had happened. It's very scary to face your offender, but we can help them still get what they the help that they need so that they can recover and be resilient, you know, no matter what. And it's so empowering and so life filling to be able to see them go through the program and through the process and get so much stronger every time, to where then they become mentors themselves.
Lisa, one other thing that stands out to me at the Air Force Wounded Warrior Program talks about invisible wounds. I mentioned Bobby Henline. He's an Army veteran, burned over 40% of his body. When Bobby walks through an airport, people know that he had a bad day. I've had, you know, Travis Mills, quadruple amputee on the show, Jason Redmond shot, you know, three times in the face. They've got there's courage and confidence that they have to carry in order to carry those physical scars every day after their incident. But I sometimes wonder, as in your case, if the invisible wounds are perhaps more difficult.
I think it kind of goes both ways. Obviously, having physical wounds that people can see, you're judged a lot. You're basically judged by how you look, is how you're perceived of what they think you can and can't do. And then in the invisible wounds, we struggle with, you don't see that I am injured or that I have PTSD. And so you just expect me to be fine. And you don't understand sometimes, you know, when I struggle. And you know, in my marriage, when early on we were struggling so much because I didn't understand that I had PTSD. I didn't understand what that even meant, to know like what I was doing was because of it. And my husband didn't understand it at all either. And I kind of joke when I share my story of, you know, he just thought I was, you know, being a giant bee. And
thank you for remembering, you know, it's a family show, Lisa.
Yes. You know, and being, you know, being difficult or being rude to him. And then in turn, he would be spiteful back to me. And I wasn't doing those things to hurt him on purpose. I was doing those things because that's just how I knew to react. And I didn't know how to react any other way. And so we've learned together. But it's hard. I spend time with people that, well, you're always so happy. So there's really it's not as bad as you think that it is. Well, just that's because you see me on my good days. On my bad days, I don't even leave my house. And you don't see that part.
And I certainly don't mean to make light of or to denigrate the physical wounds as well. I mean, if someone's hurt, they're hurt, whether that's a visible scar or if it's, you know, a traumatic brain injury. And those all create challenges. I know in Jason Redmond's case, I don't know if you know of Jason. He's a Navy SEAL. He was shot three times in the face. And initially, he started wearing a T-shirt that had an image of the X-ray of his face after the wounds. And he added, "I was shot three times in the face by a machine gun. You would have been killed." That was his way of addressing how people, you know, when people stared at him. Sure. And now he's moved on to a much more sophisticated way of helping people. But when we come back, Lisa, I want to talk a little bit about, because this is, you know, you said you didn't understand that you were afflicted with these, the results of your attack. And I'm guessing lots of folks out there also may have the same challenge or know someone who has the same challenge. So if you don't mind, when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about maybe what some of those symptoms or those indicators are of invisible wounds. Sure. And hopefully we can help some folks moving forward. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Lisa Goad. If you know of someone who could use some help, please call the National Suicide Hotline, 800-273-8255. The Veterans Crisis Hotline, 800-273-8255, press button 1. You can also find out more at veteranscrisisline.net or text 838-255. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Lisa Goad. Lisa is an Air Force Wounded Warrior Program peer, mentor, and ambassador. And we're talking a little bit about, and I use the word scourge, just some data from a recent Department of Defense study. In 2018, 325 active duty service members died by suicide. That's the highest rate since the Department of Defense began collecting data in 2001. 139 soldiers, 68 sailors, 60 airmen, 58 Marines. Just to give you some perspective, the 2017 suicide rate among active duty members was 21.9 deaths per 100,000 members. Our civilian rate in that year was 17.4 deaths per 100,000. The National Guard has the highest rate, 29.1 members took their lives by suicide per 100,000 members. Lisa, I want to hearken back to your role as a defender protecting others, and in many ways you're still doing this as a peer mentor. We talked about how so often these invisible wounds, it's not obvious, not just to a family member or an outsider, but maybe to the victim themselves. What kinds of things through your experience and your training should people be looking for that might be an indicator?
Sure. So I mean, the biggest things, like for me, were, really my depression, not willing to get out of bed. I had a lot of negative thoughts. And hopelessness, kind of like nothing, no matter what was going to happen or no matter what I did, it was just always going to be negative, or something bad was always going to happen. A lot of other things, not for me in particular, but you can, family members, or I'm sorry, giving things away to your family members, people saying goodbye. But unfortunately, what I've kind of learned this past year too, as being an ambassador, is a lot of people have said after the fact of how there was no signs whatsoever, and there wasn't any indication where somebody could have reached out and to help. And so through General Goldfein's Tactical Pause Day, what I've tried to kind of share when I share my story is how important it is for us as a military family to know each other, so that we know how we are every day, how we react, how we behave, or how we talk. And so, you don't, and I always say, like, I joke, you don't have to get along with everybody, or we don't get along with all of our family members, our blood family. So maybe you're not going to get along with all of your coworkers, but that doesn't mean you can't get to know each other, to have each other's back and take care of each other. That way, when that day does come that the person is starting to behave differently, and maybe so subtly that it's not noticed, that you'll be able to see that and can help that person, get help if they need it. And, I talk about how absolutely uncomfortable it is to go up to somebody and to ask them if they're okay, specifically asking if they're going to think about killing themselves. And it's so hard. And so we tend not to do it because we're afraid of losing that person as a friend or whatever. But you have to ask those questions because you don't want to wonder to yourself and then come to work the next day and find out that member is gone.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you said that, because that's something, I mean, just, yes, it might be uncomfortable and you might get a funny look. And you know what? If they're okay and they're perfectly healthy, no worries. I can't imagine anybody's going to be insulted because you want to reach out and help them. Speaking of which, thank you, Lisa, for waiting till almost the end of the program to remind me that it's pronounced General David Goldfein rather than Goldfein. Oh. Now I will never get him on the show. But part of what you touched on was that you think, based from what you've seen, I know you're out now, but as far as this resiliency operational pause, is that part of it? Is just having people do something as simple as sit down and get to know each other?
Through the ambassador program, and then especially living here in San Antonio, there's so many units that had requested ambassadors. And so I had the opportunity to speak to, over a dozen units that I was able to see how they all differently and uniquely did their tactical pause, but all had the same outcome in that sense of, breaking up into small groups for most of them, and to really kind of talk about what they can do as individuals. A big point that was brought on is, yes, this is a problem that's happening in our Air Force, but this is not something that big Air Force is doing wrong. This is something we as individuals have to take control of and fix, because we're the ones that are down at that tactical level and that intimate level, getting to know each other, where we're the only ones that are going to be able to respond to each other and help each other. And that was through all of the units that I was able to brief and spend time with. That seemed to be the biggest theme of, just knowing each other's behaviors. And one unit in particular, they invited me to stay with them for the whole day, which was great. And that was one of the biggest points that they kind of brought up was, we work in an environment where it's work, work, work all day, and there's very little time to kind of chit chat and whatnot. But you can tell if your buddy's not acting the right way just by either how their work output is or how secluded that they become when there is opportunity to, to relax. And I honestly think that's the only way that we can, one of the only ways that we can really kind of step forward with this is attack it at that intimate level.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because whether it's a colonel or a general or even a, a senior enlisted person, they don't interact with every airman on a regular basis every day. And I would guess there's probably sort of an automatic barrier there where there's still a reluctancy to come out and admit that you're struggling, certainly not to a senior officer.
Correct. Yeah. Even if those people are in your environment, it's so uncomfortable to come forward. You're more likely to connect with your peers either by age or rank or maybe just, that small unit of, our office that's spends all day together, and they're, like you said, they're going to be more relatable than, not that you can't go to that leadership, but you certainly may feel more comfortable with somebody that you spend every day with.
I tell you, one of the greatest honors of my life was when a commander of a United States fast attack submarine called me a shipmate. As a civilian, mm-hmm. That just made a whole wow. The idea of being a wingman as well, it's not just a word, it's a lifestyle. You have to, if you're going to be a wingman, be a wingman. And sometimes that calls for doing something uncomfortable. Folks, one more reminder, the National Suicide Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255. The Veterans Crisis Hotline, 1-800-273-8255. Press the button 1 when they answer. You can also visit veteranscrisisline.net or text 838-255. Lisa, I want to read, just to sort of wrap up here, I want to read the last three lines from the Airman's Creed. I will never leave an airman behind. I will not falter, and I will not fail. You're living that now, I believe, even though you're no longer in the active duty Air Force. Is that something you feel like you need to remind other folks in the active duty Air Force to remember every day?
I think so, and not in that negative way, but there's a very small percentage of people that serve in the military, and we need to keep that pride of what we're doing, and that will keep our family tight with us. Is remember what an honor it is to serve, and how much that we're giving of ourselves, to the military, to our country. We have to be able to take care of each other, and we have to be able to stand up. I did want to share one other thing, too, if you don't mind, if there's time.
Sure.
And so when I talked about the Air Force Wounded Warrior Program, so that is a congressionally mandated program that is you know, is funded through the DoD, there is a program like that for each branch of the service. And so even if, you know, somebody is listening and they're not Air Force, there is that specific program there for you, no matter what branch that you're in, including Coast Guard as well. And specifically, you know, for our website, right on that front page is how you can refer an airman. Anybody can refer anyone, you can refer yourself, and with the other programs likewise as well. What I love about us as the Air Force program, I'm sure others do it too, is when you reach out, even if you don't qualify to be a wounded warrior, they're going to help you find out what you need and then give you the resources and send you to those right agencies that are be able to help you. So it's not like, sorry, you don't qualify, you know, have a nice day. They're going to spend that time with you all the way through until you find the resources that you need or get connected with that correct agency. And I know the other branches do that same thing as well. And so it's an incredibly valuable program, and it's there for active duty and National Guard and Reserves that are injured or ill in the line of duty.
And that website again is woundedwarrioraf.mil. Lisa, we've got about 30 seconds. Any last things you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I just thank you so much for having this opportunity to share to your audience. I feel really honored. Thank you.
Well, again, I appreciate your courage, because I'll tell you, this is way out of my comfort zone. But that's part of being a wingman, and that's why we need to spread these messages. Lastly, one more time, folks, the National Suicide Hotline, 800-273-8255. Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273. Press 1 when they answer the phone. You can also text 838-255. This and other messages can be found podcast, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Facebook. We also have a Patreon page, patreon.com/AmericanWarrior. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.
You've been listening to the podcast edition of American Warrior Radio with Ben Bueller Garcia, presented by Medicare Mentors. American Warrior Radio, telling the stories of the American men and women who protect us at home and abroad. American Warrior Radio airs Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KRDO News Radio 105.5 FM, 1240 a.m. and 92.5 FM, and is available by podcast at KRDO.com. Select the radio tab and click on podcasts.